This is the Hack Your Wealth Podcast, episode 65. Welcome to the Hack Your Wealth Podcast, where we teach wealth building hacks for lawyers, engineers, and MBAs. I'm your host, Andrew Chen. All right, thanks so much again for tuning into the podcast. For today's episode, I invited another guest to come and share their tips and strategies and insights with us. So before we jump into that, as always, I want to invite you to join the private Hack Your Wealth Facebook group. You can access that at hackyourwealth.com/FB. Definitely encourage you to join us there. It is a place for us to connect, have a two-way dialogue. I'm in there every single day, often multiple times a day, and I try to respond to every question and comment there. And it's a place where people can ask about financial independence, early retirement, tax strategies, real estate investing, side business income, online income, career transitions, career advice, or just ask about whatever's on their mind related to personal finance or career-related issues. Definitely encourage you to check that out. It's a great, friendly, helpful group of people, and we would love to have you there. Again, hackyourwealth.com/FB. All right, let's jump into today's interview. In the last episode, I had Megan McCoy and Ed Combs on the show, who are both licensed marriage and family therapists who also have a background in financial planning, to talk about some of the money-related problems that can arise in a relationship and how couples can ask thoughtful questions and observe behaviors about their partner when it comes to money to learn more about their partner's financial values and financial philosophy and how to begin to have some of those difficult conversations about money early on in a productive way. This week, we shift gears to talk about some of the money-related conflicts and fights that can occur after a couple gets married, how to recognize when those things are happening, what some of the common triggers and some of the common causes are. And we talk a lot about how to have those conflicts in an effective and productive way that also strengthens the relationship at the same time. So let's hear what both have to say. Cool. So that's a bunch of really good tips around the relationship as it develops before marriage. I would love to shift gears to some of the challenges that arise after you get married. Things are more complicated in at least some regards after you get married. Because before you get married, if you find that your partner's values about money are just fundamentally incompatible with your own, while it can be painful, it's not like catastrophic to break up, call it quits, go your separate ways. Certainly easier than after you're married, and immensely easier if you don't have kids yet. And I was just curious, in your experience, after a couple gets married, what are the most common reasons couples fight about money, and what tend to be the common triggers?
Yeah, well, the biggest one is definitely approach to money, like where you spend your money and how much you spend of your money. There's a study by Sonia Luderbrecht here at K-State. She lists some other things like couples actually fight about charitable giving a lot. People fight about what we call perceived financial stress. Like some people just get more stressed with less debt than others. And so when your partner's like not worried and you're stressed, it feels very isolating. In my practice, which is going to be a little bit more, severe cases, what I see a lot was financial infidelity. And then
what is that?
Yeah. So financial infidelity is so fascinating. It's any kind of lie to your partner about money. But if you ask someone, have you ever committed financial infidelity? Everyone says, no, I've never done that. But then if you ask people, have you ever lied by omission? Have you ever rounded down how much you spent on an item? Have you ever just not mentioned you went shopping? Then all of a sudden the rates go high. And so, of course, those aren't terrible things. But what I think it's a sign of is an inability for people to ask for what they want. Like you are shameful about your purchases. Either A, you're spending money you shouldn't be, and that's a problem. Or B, you don't feel like you can ask your partner to meet your needs. Like, I want this, I need this. And you somehow feel like you can't ask for that from your partner, which I think is horrible, because that sign, if that is true in other areas of your relationship, that's going to leave you getting your needs unmet from your partner, which is what you hope for them. That was a tangent about financial infidelity, but that's really common. And I wish people would ask for what they want. And then another huge thing is blended families. So having children from previous marriage and then fighting about how much you spend on children, having different views of how much to spend on children. And I think right now, due to COVID, we have an incredible stress around how much to financially support our adult children, whether in a blended family or in a nuclear family setting. Is how do we support them financially? Do we support them? Are we enabling them? Those are kind of issues that come up a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I think the most obvious is spending. How to allocate the funds between the two, because now you have mine, yours, and ours. And I think a lot of newlyweds have a hard time navigating this prioritization of how to spend the money, how much to spend on certain categories. That's where, those questions before getting married can be really critical in the practice of blending money. Now, most couples don't want to fully blend their financial lives until after they get married, which is understandable. But if you can have those proactive conversations before getting married about how are we going to blend our money? What are our financial priorities? Sketching out a rough budget of what life is going to look like together. Really critical. And so I think one of the biggest things where I have to do a lot of relational rehab is when partners have had a lot of conflict around money and have been judgmental, critical, contemptuous about what the partner's doing with money. John Gottman is a great marriage researcher, and he says there's the four horsemen of the apocalypse for relationships. And contempt is one of them. And I'm sorry, I'm not getting them back up in my head, but your listeners can look them up. If you're using any of those behavioral patterns around money, you're going to destroy a lot of trust, and it's going to take a lot of time to come back around to that. So that's where, kind of blending that emotional regulation, knowing how am I coming across to my partner, being able to manage your own frustrations, the relational security patterns are really important.
You mentioned spending is an obvious one. Does that problem dissipate as the couple just becomes wealthier? Like the more money they make, does that problem go away, or is it always there fundamentally at some level?
Yeah.
When that issue is in the picture.
It only intensifies. And that's one of those cognitive errors that I think a lot of us have in society is that we have this simple equation in our head that more money will mean fewer problems. And there's, what's I'm not thinking what the great rap song is, Mo Money, Mo Problems. But I'm embarrassed I can't remember it. But anyhow, what's happening beneath that phrase, more money, more problems, is the psychological misalignment between the partners. And just making more money does not improve the psychological connection between the two partners. So if we have two insecurely attached individuals from that attachment theory, right, we have four categories: secure, which means I'm generally comfortable with myself and generally comfortable trusting my partner. Anxious means I'm not really secure in myself, but I'm always looking to the other person for validation. Never really sure when they give me validation that they actually do love me and care about me. The avoidant basically says, I'm going to do me and you do you. And when you're in emotional distress, you got to go figure that out. And then disorganized is that mix of avoidant and anxious, right? So when we look at those attachment styles and then we bring it to the money table and then we're talking about spending, you can see where two securely attached individuals could sit down and work through the differences and accept the fact that they are going to be different on some spending priorities. But if you're anxious or avoidant on the attachments, your ability to have the relational trust and skills necessary to navigate spending differences and to bring things into control and perspective is going to be more likely impaired. And so just adding more money to the mix is going to be very problematic. This is where I've seen issues around financial infidelity come up, especially around the anxious partners. They don't want to disclose that they've made mistakes because they're already afraid of being rejected around spending. And they also want to often be very pleasing to their partner. And so they'll just kind of keep the checkbook open and the spending open, and they'll get in a cycle of making more money to try to keep the partner happy. I think especially, a slight shift in this pattern is the upwardly mobile professional with the partner that gets off the career track to stay home and raise the kids, and they start to split, inevitably, if that person's upwardly mobile and working more and away from the home more, there's less time for emotional relational connection. Money becomes the stand-in for that. But money can never fulfill the need for emotional relational connection fully. And so that's, you get the 20 to 30 year marriage with the kids that are late high school and they're going apart. Mm-hmm. They didn't really resolve their intimacy needs.
It sounds like that's a pretty common occurrence. And that is also a common, you know, for good or for bad, a common family arrangement, especially if there are multiple kids. It's just so difficult to, you know, balance a like a demanding family life and also a demanding career. Are there, what can couples do? Like, are there strategies or tips that couples can do intentionally and continuously to mitigate that drift?
Yeah, and so this is right. If we think about, we're moving along the lifespan of the intimate relationship. And I love your questions because you're starting out like, how do we start from the right place from the beginning? What are those right questions to start with? Then what do we do in the early phase of marriage where most couples don't have kids together, right? But I don't even say most. If you have kids right out of the gate and you're married, that's a somewhat of a different situation than like you get married, you work professionally for 3 to 5 years, and then you have kids, which is not an uncommon pattern for professionals. Well, the amount of time you have to sit down and talk about your finances and your life together is significantly more in this period of time than once kid one enters. Once kid two and three enter, the amount of time goes down significantly. And so I, what I like to encourage couples is, and I've seen this in my own life, is my wife and I don't have as many money dates where we sit down and review our spending, our investments, where we had it. What does your professional life need? What does my professional life need? Okay, here's how we're going to go forward. Right? Ideally, you want to meet on that, you know, once a month, once a quarter. But then there's all the money decisions that happen in between that. And those are kind of the one, you know, the ad hoc or as needed money talks. And I think being able to have that expectation that that's going to be needed and need to happen is pretty important. So you want to have that balance of being able to have ad hoc money conversations and then to know, like, and this depends on the temperament of the couple, but they know that they're going to meet together once a month or once a quarter, something that's on some regular rhythm. I think it can also be very helpful as the relationship is maturing is to identify a fee-only financial planner that can act as the third in your relationship. Because a really good financial planner is going to be able to ask both parties about their values, what they want, and how they're doing and getting them. And it takes pretty mature individuals to be able to do that in the relationship just for themselves. Right? We're all biased towards knowing what we want more than the other person. And holding the other person's needs in mind can be challenging for some of us. So that's where I think, you know, getting that financial planner to help you start critically thinking through your financial life becomes even more important.
Got it. Besides spending, potential spending conflicts, are there other common reasons married couples fight about money in your experience, or common triggers that cause it?
Spending money is that high level, like how money is spent is the high level piece. But when we drill down into that, what are we talking about? Well, there's the food, the housing, the cars, vacations. But then there's this other area that a lot of couples end up in, which is family support and money.
Say more about that.
So do I have a mother or mother-in-law that needs financial support, or a brother or sister that needs ongoing financial support? You know, some extended family member that may become financially dependent on you and your spouse. what's the right or appropriate level of financial provision for that family member? How do we have that conversation with each other, find that balance of support? Or do we support, and what are our limits there? That can get into some pretty tricky water pretty quickly.
How, that's hard. How do you do that?
Yeah, right. Good question. So ideally what you're doing is you're coming, starting from a place of financial empathy and empathy for your partner or your spouse. And that the likely mixed feelings they have about providing support for that family member. You know, I think we would like to think that we're all very altruistic individuals, and that of course we'd want to take care of our family members, but that's just not reality. I think we all have mixed feelings. And so I think part of the how you do it is normalizing that they probably are having mixed feelings about it, and giving them space to talk about the mix of feelings that they have about it. It's incredible how being engaged in that type of process, solutions will emerge, right? And so that's where, you know, for me, especially when I'm working with couples as a therapist, they're coming to me wanting a solution to the problem. But more often what I do is engage them in a process of talking with each other about what they're experiencing, what their expectations are, how things that they've seen in the past may be shaping what they're thinking, how things should be going now. And as they hear each other, they start to recognize and see their shared humanity and the challenge of it. And it positions them into often a more collaborative stance of saying, okay, well, now in light of this, what are we gonna do? What makes the most sense? And sometimes these issues are, you know, the needs are chronic, or in that, you know, the elderly parent is not gonna get meaningful work, is not gonna have a substantial change in their financial life. And so you do have to come to some difficult conversations about, do they come move in with us? Do we provide a certain amount of money on a reoccurring basis? Or do we just say, you know, I'm sorry, there's nothing that we can do. We're going to put our own financial life in jeopardy. And so those aren't easy conversations, but they do come up more than we are able to talk about with our friends.
Yeah. I imagine those are, you know, especially tricky as well, because they're also just hard to talk about. And I'm just curious, are there ways to bring those kinds of issues up before you even get married, so that you at least can be more intentional about going into that kind of situation, if that makes sense?
Yeah. You know, I think it's one of those great questions. So kind of in the money conversations, what money conversations we have is having that conversation. Tell me a little bit about your parents. You know, what does their financial life look like? What do you imagine ever being financially responsible for your parents in the future? If so, what are your thoughts and feelings about it at this time? How do you think, you know, we would cross that bridge? You know, life is full of so many uncertainties that you can't always fully predict or be prepared for all these things. But I think you can have some proactive conversations on the front end around what are the thoughts and what are the expectations. And again, you're going to get a sense for their values and their sense of clarity. You know, when they answer that question, you know, answering those questions for yourself. God, what is my parents' financial reality? I mean, the reality is that many people live with at least one, within the couple, at least one set of parents is divorced, which adds complexity, right? If not both. And so you've got family members kind of can be all over the place, and being able to think about, well, what are my family's expectations of me? And if you're if you don't know, this is also a great time, depending on the quality of relationship you have, is to go have that conversation with mom and dad and say, what are your expectations of me as an adult and financially? And they, you know, again, this depends on the overall family culture, how open they're going to be to having these types of conversations. in what I understand to be healthy family culture, you can have these types of conversations with pretty good responses. But some parents are going to feel really uncomfortable about that. They're not going to want those kind of conversations to come up. And if that's the reality, then that's just something to know and to be aware of that you're going to be working with.
In scenarios where one spouse's side of the family needs this kind of recurring financial support, and yet the spouse is, I guess, at some base level disagree about either whether to provide that support or how much support to provide, do those... are those situations in your experience tenable? Like, or do they, more often than not, like, end up in a bad place?
I've seen it go both ways for sure. And it, you know, not to overly harp on any one concept, but I think it is to some degree allow that to build resentment and anger. So I think if in a healthy relational process, you can talk about and acknowledge that these are maybe perpetual differences between the two of us, but that we still are committed to each other in the long term, our long-term relationship. And the reality is that that external financial reality, external to the couple, will likely also be shaping the couple's financial expectations of what they want to create for themselves in the future. So a number of couples that I've worked with have had the financially dependent parent and they don't want that for themselves. And so they can become hyper-vigilant to wanting to create wealth or financial security for themselves. And it can create an unbalance there if the other person is not on that same board or doesn't understand that that's part of the driving component is that fear of, I don't want to end up like mom or dad.
Really insightful. I was curious, do you generally support this notion of like separate, you know, no questions asked individual accounts in marriages?
Yeah, so I don't, because my goal is I just wish everybody talked too much. And for me, having your resources pooled will net you more money, right? Like having your money together, because money makes money, is better on paper financially. Of course, I would never tell a client you have to combine accounts because it is so individually based. But when I see couples as separate accounts, again, what that signals to me is maybe it's just like you haven't gotten around to it, but it signals to me maybe someone doesn't feel like they can ask for what they want. Mm-hmm. And that's really at the end of the day what I want people to do. And so if you feel like you have to have a separate account because you don't trust your partner to be aligned with your financial goals, that stinks. And if you need a separate account because you don't want to tell your partner what you're spending because you have shame, that stinks. And if you need a separate account because you're afraid to ask for what you need from your partner, that stinks. So I think a lot of the reasons that joint accounts exist are negative, not the necessarily the joint account itself.
Got it. I was curious, actually, a twist on that, because some couples and even counselors would advise not necessarily having totally separate accounts. You still have mostly joint accounts, but you have like you each have like a small discretionary account, kind of like play money, maybe a couple $100 a month, whatever it is. Yeah. Just so that there's kind of the no questions asked on small discretionary purchases. Do you recommend this approach?
You know, I don't recommend it because, again, I just feel like you should be able to do that. If you make enough and you can financially afford it, you should be able to say, I'm buying this because I want to. But again, if it works for couples, I don't like to fix what's not broken. You know, I think if you feel like you have an ability to say that you just don't want to, then it's fine to have joint accounts. What I'd rather a couple do is have all these accounts named after different things that they want in the future. Like, one person really wants to go to Europe. One person really wants to get a boat. And you guys can have separate accounts where you just throw your extra surplus money in there in the goals you want. And then you guys have like a goal competition. I think that would be better.
Got it.
I think more often than not, it can be coming from a place of good intention, just wanting to have, just make things run smoother. But I think beneath the surface for many couples, there can be some real fear and anxiety. There can also be some direct family messages about, you know, honey, you need to keep your own money, right? I think a lot of women get that message, especially when their parents went through a contentious divorce and money, you know, and alimony were not provided correctly. That can leave a lot of emotional residue and a need for some sense of self-protection and self-preservation. I think it can be a short-term solution, but probably is not a long-term great option. This is where I'm very careful in these types of places, is because it's really dependent on the level of relational security and trust. If there's high degrees of relational security and trust, and each person just wants to have a little money to go and do whatever they want to do with, fine. But I think if that's going to be the case, there also needs to be a place for there's financial transparency. If some you do need to ask, or I don't think you can just spend without your partner ever checking in on you, right? Yeah, you like, if the intention is I just want to be able to spend the money without you being critical of the fact that I like mountain bikes, or I like video games, or I like musical equipment, or I like, you know, pumps, you know, shoes. Okay, so be it. But I think the deeper question you have to ask yourself is, if your partner's showing up with you around your money that way, maybe there's a deeper issue that needs to be addressed. Why are you being critical of your partner in the way that they spend money? Part of the way we spend money is an expression of who we are as a person. And so if you're being critical of your partner in the way that they spend money, there's probably something else there that needs to be really addressed at a deeper level.
Super helpful. Okay, cool. So you talked a little bit about some of the common reasons and triggers that folks fight, married folks fight about money. What are some of the best practices that you've observed for how spouses can fight productively and effectively in a way that keeps the relationship healthy and even strengthens it? I think you called this like a good fight. What are the characteristics of that, and how do you make sure the fight is good rather than bad?
Yeah. You know, I love this article that some friends of mine wrote, Sarah Acevedo and Emily Perdon. It was called Conflict Resolution and Financial Planning. But they use this analogy that I would love to plagiarize from them now. Sorry for being long-winded, but what the analogy is that two little boys come in the kitchen screaming, fighting about an orange. They both want the last orange in the house. And the dad goes, stop fighting, I'm gonna throw the orange out, right? The mom goes, oh, I'll cut it in half for you guys to both have half. And then the grandmother, who was a conflict resolution mediator, said, no, why do you guys want the orange? Tell me what your end goal is. What do you want out of the orange? And one kid had wanted the orange to make these muffins, where he needed to scrape the orange peel, and the other kid wanted the juice and to squeeze it and make orange juice. And so the grandmother said, okay, here's the rind, here's the orange juice. And what's cool about this is it demonstrates different ways we can do conflict resolution. Like, the dad was like a no win, right? No one wins. Let's just everybody get punished. The mom was what's called compromise, which usually we would say, oh, that's the greatest thing ever. Let's compromise and give up a little bit for our partners. But when you compromise, you're actually giving up something. And that's what I don't want for anybody. So the grandmother did it so well by saying, let's define what do you need at the end of this conflict. Let's start with that in mind. And I think that's a beautiful thing. If you could say, what need do you need to be met? What is missing, or what can I help you with at the end of this conflict that we know we walked away successfully? And that would be such a shift for all of us to start that way, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Negotiation, that this is often referred to as, you know, focusing on interests rather than positions.
Yeah.
So it definitely makes sense and resonates.
Yeah. I think that's a really important question to answer. And so, because there will be some couples that fall on the conflict avoidance side of the continuum, where they feel frustration and anger about financial topics, but they won't bring it up. But that can be just as destructive as having the loud knockdown drag out fights, because ultimately nothing's getting resolved in either of those contexts. So what you want to be able to do is to be able to come again. I use that word empathy, but when you have that financial disagreement, is being willing to be vulnerable and go into the conversation and be curious about what's going on for their partner, what needs are they wanting to get fulfilled in this disagreement, and then being able to say, this is what I'm needing, and having that relational expectation that your partner will want to meet and understand that as well. This all comes out of secure attachment and secure patterns of relating in the relationship, right? So it's, we're applying it to money dynamics, but it really can be, secure relationship patterns are important for parenting kids, for sexual intimacy, for dealing with the in-laws, right? For negotiating work patterns, navigating spirituality, right? Our attachment pattern is such a huge predictor of the way that we experience our intimate relationship. So we're just using attachment to help us know, well, what are the right ways to talk about money, right, in this conversation? There's a lot of research, and this is where a lot of the couples therapy work is focused on, helping couples identify their attachment patterns and move to what's called earned secure attachment, right? If we want to remember about attachment, is the relationally learned process. It's the quality of the way that interactions between our primary caregivers were between us. So no, they don't just change on a dime. They're deeply embedded within our neural networks. But as we experience new relational patterns and more relational security, we can move towards more of that secure functioning, right? The secure functioning has an internal expectation that my needs will be met, that I'll be understood, and that I'll be accepted for who I am. And then I'm going to offer that to the other person. So that's where like empathy is a key skill in forming secure attachment, because empathy is that ability to imagine the other person's state and what it means to them and accurately reflect it back to them. Two books I would recommend is Love Sense by Dr. Sue Johnson. She does a phenomenal job of helping people understand what an attachment style is, what it means, and what you can do about it in the intimate relationship. If you find that you know that you grew up in this environment that was not relationally secure or stable, was very threatening to you, Diane Poole Heller has a phenomenal book called Healing Your Attachment Wounds. And that's going to get into much deeper levels of the way that our attachment system can become injured. So for couples though, you know, if you're not going into therapy, you need to find those self-help books on attachment. Practically, one of the best things to do is to just be able to see, can we even look at each other in the eye? And do that safely. And that, just practicing being able to sit with each other and looking into each other's eyes, will start to build connection between the couple. So take the money, take everything off the table. If you're finding that you're having trouble getting on the same page, see if you can do some experiments with each other about looking into each other's eyes and feeling comfortable with that. That is being held psychologically safe. Right? We're looking into each other's eyes as we're having this conversation right now. And it creates a sense of like, oh, Andrew's here with me. He's interested in what I'm saying. It allows me to continue to want to engage with you. Right? That's what we get when we get eye contact. That's a big part of building attachment.
While there might be creative ways, definitely I agree, to reach the outcome, like in the orange analogy, where one person gets the rind and the other person gets the orange itself, and basically each person got the entirety of what they wanted. When it comes to money, you know, often there are compromises because there's just finite resources. And I was just curious, are there areas you've observed where it is especially helpful for couples and spouses to learn how to compromise when it comes to money and finances?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, creating a budget together and really having both partners recognize the finite resources they have. And then again, making sure that both partners are bought into the goal you have for saving those finite resources. Maybe it's simply just not getting the credit card debt. But if one partner is like, credit card debt's fine, then they're not going to work as hard as the other partner. Mm-hmm. And so again, I think it all starts with a very simple tracking spending and budgeting so that you can, you know, be intentionally spending and recognizing how much of the finite resource you actually have before you start.
Got it. So budgeting and tracking spend, Are there any other, I guess, areas where you have found it particularly, I guess, good return on investment, so to speak, to have a compromising, you know, mindset or orientation?
Yeah, I mean, again, making sure that you guys are both in the right place, making sure you don't do that whole actor observer bias where you're not immediately jumping to conclusions about their personality, really truly believing that your partner is your teammate and you're going in this together. And then again, I think a huge mistake couples make is that they don't define what they're working for. You know, we're working for a house. And then you name your savings account house. And then when you make sacrifices at Starbucks or you make sacrifices at Target, you can open your account and look at that house 22 savings account and be like, this is what my dream is. This is what I want. And this is more important than whatever purchase I'm going to. The problem is a lot of times couples, only one partner has that dream. And then you have to shift the dream and say, okay, what is our actual shared dream? What do we actually want together? And maybe a short-term and long-term goals, and one person's working more for the long-term goal and one person's working more for the short-term goal.
How do you address those scenarios where they're actually the dream that one partner has is not the dream that the other person has who has a different dream of their own?
Yeah, I think talking about it is explaining why that dream is important. What does it symbolize? You know, who cares about a house? Like, it doesn't really matter. But what we really care about is the sign and symbol of reaching adulthood, the sign and symbol of ownership and success. And so if you say, I want a house, don't you want a house? It makes sense to want a house. The partner might be like, no, I don't want a house, I don't care. But if you say, I dream of feeling grown up, I dream of feeling like I've succeeded, then your partner's like, well, I want that for you too. Like, yeah, I want to make you feel like you've succeeded in life. I want to work towards that goal too. And so I think oftentimes we tend to say the same thing over and over again, just louder and louder, and taking a step back and said, you know, maybe we hit this issue 3 times so far and I haven't made a difference. How can I approach it differently? How can I explain, you know, my needs or my wants to my partner in a way that'll be more receptive?
I'd love to run a hypothetical by you just to really flush this out. Okay. So let's say you have a married couple and one of them, exactly as you said, they want to buy a house. And when asked why, they say, well, I always envisioned myself moving into like a dream home and just living there forever. And I want to build up memories. Like I want to have memories both for like us and, you know, our kids or whatever. The other person, it doesn't particularly require house. House is fine, but doesn't particularly require a house. But anyway, doesn't value or agree that necessarily buying a house in the place that they're living makes sense because for any number of factors, it's a lot of work to maintain a house and do the yard work. It's cheaper to rent perhaps where they're living. They can live in a more convenient location if they're renting, like maybe more in the city center, whatever the reasons are. But they think that a house, which is a big financial investment, will not, you know, sort of be in service of their own goals. What would you say to a couple like this?
Yeah, I mean, I would just encourage to keep on having conversations, because one thing that struck me about the first person who said I always dreamt about the house is it was something like I just always had dreamt about it. And you know, a lot of times we get sold on a belief or something that we think we should do. And it might not even be what you care about. Maybe you don't actually care about the house. You just want stability. And maybe renting can give you the same stability. So I think what I'm trying to say is, one, recognizing what we really care about and really being able to explain, these are the reasons why I care about. Number two, being open that both partners may be right, that maybe partially right. Maybe it's that you guys need to buy a condo, like something in between where you bought it, so it's yours and you have stability, but you get to live in the city for the other partner. So I think going back to that conflict resolution skills is being open to hearing your partner, being more prioritizing more understanding your partner than getting what you want. I think that's the key. Because then once you understand your partner, then you can figure out how you can adjust what you want to meet your partner's needs.
Yeah, that's good advice. Cool. Are there any practices or rituals that you have observed that couples or spouses do intentionally to keep their relationships healthy when it comes to money matters?
Yeah. So I can tell you, I did a study with my friend Ken White, and we found out that 90% of people in our sample had not talked to anyone about money in a year. Can you imagine going a whole year without talking about money, whether it be like, oh, you know, these are my financial goals, or this is how I'm saving money, or I don't know. How do you not talk to your partner, your kids, or your parents about money an entire year? It blows my mind. And of course, there's some methodological reasons, like the sample was skewed, and that's why the number was so high. But the point of the matter is that we need to talk about money. And again, thinking about that Gottman ratio of 1 to 5, we need to get those positive financial conversations going. So I love the analogy of the house CEO meeting, where you guys as a team come together once a month, put in your Google Calendar or your Outlook calendar, like pre-schedule it for like once a month on a Friday, you know, get the music on you like, get the favorite food, and just talk about how we do on our financial goals. What do we want to do better in? Are we saving for our future the way we want to be? So I think having something set up on the calendar to automatically do every month would be the most beautiful gift for your partner.
You're talking about like a planned conversation around money monthly. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. Planned. I would love for it to be about your spending plan. Like, are you on track for your spending plan? And what categories should we make bigger or smaller? But really, I don't even care to get that much detailed. Like, just talking about what are our financial goals, and are we on track, and are we focused on the right goals is really what I want for everybody.
Are there any like activity-based rituals or even spending type of rituals that you have found to be effective to do together to actually keep the relationship healthy on money matters?
Well, I think, again, one of the big ones, I think Brad Klontz is who I copied this from, but naming your savings account, having more than one savings account and really naming them your goals, but don't just call it, like I said earlier, like house 2022, but don't call it house 2022, call it dream home 2022. Like, have the goal in some evocative term that makes you think of like how much joy you'll get when you reach that goal, and the year that you want to reach that goal by in the title of the savings account. So it could be as simple as every Friday, the first Friday of every month, we just open up our goals, see where we are, think about how long it'll take us to reach those goals, think if which one we want to focus on most this month. That would be a huge win for every couple if they just did that.
Got it. Incidentally, the naming of accounts, because I haven't personally done that, so it's an interesting suggestion. I was curious, is the theory behind it just that it keeps reinforcing to you every time you open the account, kind of like the way that you described the anticipation of planning for a vacation, et cetera?
Yeah, the anticipation for everything is better than the actual it. So have you ever heard of the hedonistic treadmill? Okay, so we have this level of happiness that we actually like to be in. Each of ours is different. And no matter how good something is, like winning the lottery, what we find is just a few months later, we go right back into that average. And so what's actually better than these huge wins is lots of little micro wins. And so opening up your account for Italy and saying, like, let's say wine country 2022, and seeing that go from 5 to 200 to 400, whatever it is, will give you more pleasure than actually going to Italy. Like, anticipating that trip will give you more pleasure than actually going. And so, yeah, naming multiple accounts, and again, having the years that you're being pressed to, like, I have to reach this goal in that time, and having evocative, like, emotionally driven terms rather than something simple are really the keys to that.
Got it. Cool. So my audience tends to skew toward people who are interested in the FIRE movement, which is an acronym that stands for Financial Independence, Retire Early. In some cases, that means saving and investing enough early on to retire extremely early, like maybe in your 40s or even 30s. For folks who have a serious goal to retire decades early, do you have any advice for how to get your spouse on board with the idea of early retirement and the financial choices and likely sacrifices that might be required to make that happen? Obviously, if you marry someone who happens to already want the same thing is probably going to be easier. But FIRE is a niche community, I'd say, and a niche financial philosophy. And most people probably haven't even heard of it, let alone want to commit to pursuing it. So just curious if you have any advice for someone who has already decided that's what they want to do, that's their dream, and trying to convince their spouse to the same idea.
Yeah, I think the more you share with your partner how much, what life will look like for you after retirement, why you're working so hard, the more you're able to share that passion without any kind of strings attached, the more bought in they will. The clearer you can be for yourself why you care about it, the clearer you can be with your partner, and then your partner will be like, oh, I want you to reach that goal too. It matters so much to you. A little funny side note is that I teach an intro to financial planning course, and every year I send my students to the FIRE Reddit page because they have the best tips on how to spend money intentionally, how to spend money in ways that actually make you happy. You know, a lot of the FIRE Reddit is actually purchase decisions, and how saving up 3 months for that TV felt so good to not have to do any, you know, credit with it or so, you know, so on. And that idea of like, you can spend money as long as you have a plan, as long as you know where that money is going, as long as you're being mindful. I think I wish every American had, whether FIRE or not FIRE.
Got it. So you mentioned try to share that, you know, dream of yours in a no strings attached way. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? No strings attached, for clarity. And then at some point, perhaps the strings need to attach because you need to get the person on board. And so I was curious, any advice for how to actually do that effectively without making the other person feel like they're sort of being dragged along, if that makes sense.
Right. So hopefully the more clear you are about what life will look like after retirement, the more they'll be bought in. It was so interesting when I did one of my early first sessions with financial planners, where me and the financial planner met with clients together. We had this client who every week was like, I can't wait to retire so I can fish. And he would say that every week. And then one week he said, and I was like, well, how much do you get to fish now? And he's like, oh, I never go fishing. And I'm like, how are you planning 20 to 60 years of your life on activity you don't even do nowadays, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think a lot of us dream about retirement without saying what that retirement is actually going to look like. You know, how long can you sit and look in the sunset? And so I think instead of having conversations, I can't wait to retire, is I can't wait to be free of this job that doesn't make me happy. And instead of being stressed, I'll be doing my passion. Or I can't wait to just travel the world and see all these places. I think spinning it from getting away from retirement into what does this new life look like for you and your partner, and how will it benefit you and your partner, is what I was talking about with the no strings attached. It's not about changing behaviors. It's about getting their buy-in and how will their life be better once you guys retire. I think that's the first. And I think once you get strings attached, it has to be how both people are making sacrifices and both people are getting what they want. So maybe looking at your line by line track spending, and talking to them and like, what are these purchases are you proud of that you know that brought you great joy that are worth it? And which of these purchases were just because you were late or you were rushing or you weren't thinking about things when we bought? And how can we remove those purchases and keep the ones that you actually care about in our budget so that we can reach our goals?
Got it. Like Marie Kondo style.
Yeah. Really, if you have less, if you do less, but they all bring you joy, you'll be happier.
All right. Megan, this has been such a treat. That's all I got. Where can listeners find out more about you, your work, and what you're up to?
Yes, I'm on LinkedIn, but also visit our K-State page. If any of you guys are financial planners, I am so proud of the Financial Therapy Certificate at K-State, where we teach courses on money and relationships and how financial professionals can help couples talk about money. We teach courses on how to deal with resistant clients and how to just ask the best questions you can to your clients. So if anyone's interested in that, they can check out our K-State Financial Therapy page as well.
All right. Awesome. We'll definitely link to that in the show notes. I'll probably reach out to you as well for some of the article links that you referenced, and we'll link to those as well. Thanks so much for taking the time to chat with me, and you know, best of luck to you, and stay safe out there.
Thank you. You too. Thank you.
Great. You're welcome, Andrew. It was a pleasure to be with you. And you asked some phenomenal questions. And I love that you're thinking about the whole arc of the relationship, and building a healthy relationship from the beginning is a great great measure to take.
All right, that's a wrap. I hope you enjoyed today's guest interview and got a lot of value and insights from it. If you like this episode, please hit that subscribe button to get new episodes automatically sent to you. Would love for you to not miss any episodes, because the Hack Your Wealth podcast has a mix of action-packed solo shows where I walk you through specific strategies and tactics step by step, as well as guests who share their expertise about specific areas of personal finance, and finally profile interviews of business owners who are trying to turn their side hustles into fully financially self-sustaining passive income streams. We break down exactly what they do, how they do it, and how much they're earning. So be sure to subscribe so you don't miss any of that great content. Also, would love if you could help me out and take 30 seconds to go to Apple Podcasts and leave a podcast review. It helps to support this podcast and it helps other people who are looking for topics like this find the podcast. And I really appreciate it if you could take a minute and just leave an honest review. All right, that's it for this week. Thanks for tuning in, and we will see you next time. Thanks for listening to the Hack Your Wealth podcast with Andrew Chen. If you like the show, please leave us a review on iTunes and check out hackyourwealth.com for all our latest content.